All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. All right, guys, welcome to episode 136 of American Vindicta. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. What do we have on the list today? Well, just going over some of my favorite websites. And I'm still working on editing videos that we took over the weekend of our exploration through some caves and other places in Arkansas, which is going to be really cool. Hopefully, I will have one hitting tonight. I know I said I was going to do it last night, but software editing and me don't get along right now until I learn how to use this stuff. But anyways, I'm going to be trying it. So let's go over some stuff that's in the news. Well, I'm sure many of you have heard already that the Democrats have launched their propaganda desperate blitz that is happening in D.C. right now over January 6th. Why now? They've had an entire year to bring up this crap, and yet now they decide is a good time to talk about it. Well, I'll just tell you this much. They're losing the propaganda scare. People are starting to really wake up to the fact that the government is lying to you. People are really starting to wake up to the fact that the Unselect Committee of January 6th is a completely botched kangaroo court that is meant to implicate half of America as domestic enemies of the government. Not of the United States. Not of the United States government. But to this government. I want to make that fact very, very clear. We were not a threat to Donald Trump. We were not a threat to Barack Obama or to George Bush. We were not a threat to any of the prior presidents. But this president and his committees think that right now is the time to label half of America as violent domestic extremist or even to the extent of terrorist. Why do you think so, though? Why now? And what do they have on us? What, we're a little bit too patriotic? Ultra MAGA is running loose and rampant. I think the mere fact that the Democrats have lost the stranglehold over their usual constituents is one of the reasons why they have to generate more fear. Now, if you've followed me for some time, I'm going to tell you something that you've probably heard of and you're going to hear it again. What we see happening in America are events. And these events, January 6th, all the stuff that happened with the George Floyd incident, all the different riots, the stuff happening in Ukraine, the food scares, the fuel scares, the toilet paper scare, the COVID scare, and then the injection scare, and then we have now the fuel shortage scare. These things are driving the next series of events. And by that, what I mean is that the politicians have always told us never let a crisis go to waste, especially a good crisis. So what they do with each driving event, they write a narrative as to how they can control this event. I don't think I've ever gone too deep into my theology here on why I believe this, but this is my basis, okay? Each event has a purpose behind it. It was premeditated for the most part, and we can prove quite a bit of it. It's premeditated. It's funded by outside sources of income, i.e. George Soros, or the World Health Organization, or Klaus Schwab, and all these other clowns. And they drive the characters that are played in the scenarios of the event. Every event, let's say the monkeypox, okay, will have different scenarios tied into it. By scenarios, I mean, you're going to have the mainstream media. That is one portion of the scenario. So they have to cover and carry the coverage of monkeypox. And then the characters that play in that are going to be your politicians. They're going to be your Bill Gates. They're going to be your George Soros. They're going to be your advocacy groups. Every now and then you're going to get a congressman who will follow the narrative-driven line. And these are our characters, okay? So if you want to ever map this out in your head, what it is that you're seeing, you're not seeing random sequences of ones and zeros. These are very manipulated facts, very manipulated series of consequences that we are going to go through. And we will go through them, just like how we went through COVID. And we saw that COVID was very manipulated. COVID was very well funded. COVID was very well broadcasted, carried on by the news, 24/7 death counter. That is why I tell you these things are event-driven and they have narratives that link them together. Along with every narrative, take for instance right now the active shooter narrative. There are consequences, and these consequences or what I identify as the policies, rules, procedures, and laws. The policies and the rules and the procedures. Policies are government-driven. The rules are the things that they say that we should all abide by because they can't make a law out of it. And then you have the actual laws that they drive. And in between there are procedures. The procedural route is the way every state or every government entity will have different ways of how they view the data, of how they describe the data on a public forum, or how they take the data and keep it in their private banks, their intelligence banks, how they gather the data, how they review the data, and then how they presume to make their assumptions off of the data that drives the next narrative for the next series of events. Because what we see is government-driven. It's not populace-driven. The populace cannot unelect their own constitutional rights, just as the Congress and Senate cannot unelect its own people. And because of that, it's up to us to unelect them, to unseat them. So there's a little battle going back and forth between we the people and them the government. Not all are bad in the government. I worked there for 14 years. Not all are bad. Many of them, I would say, I wouldn't trust with a carrot and a stick to lead me to the next series of events because there is so much compartmentalization, that each entity of the government only gets bits and pieces. Okay. They only get bits and pieces, and they make up the series, the paragraphs of the narrative. And these narratives are the things that are given to the House Intelligence Committee. And the House Intelligence Committee will then take it. They will make their assumptions and their procedures. They'll make their rules, their recommendations, and legislations based off of what they are given and how they are to go forward with the next series of events and narratives. Does that make sense to you? This is the way it's done. It's not the perfect way. It's not the absolute way. But it is the way that it's done. Now, the problem here is when you have one side of the government, like right now, an entirely leftist wing of the government that is hell-bent on destroying this country, you have a problem with what narratives are factual and accurate, what events are factual and accurate, and what events are manufactured. Back in the day when I first started this, terrorism was what we were after. It was the narrative driving the terrorism-related incidents and events. Every time we had a terrorism-related event, back then it was all violent Muslim extremists. So with each shooting, with each bombing, with each improvised explosive device that we found, there would be an event made out of it, and then there would be a corresponding narrative wrote to it. This is the way law enforcement does these things. We would have an incident control number labeled to every event, and then from there, it is pushed up the chain of command, and it's eventually all given to the House Intelligence Committee and the other corresponding factions of the government, and then they disseminate the information as they will. The problem with back then compared to right now, and even back then when Obama was in charge, it is not nearly as heavily one-sided in the government as it was then compared to now. Even when I was still first introduced into DHS, a very large portion of us had come from the recent battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan, to include my seniors, my supervisors, even some assistant directors and directors were all of people of battlefield experience. So we all kind of have a general understanding of what's happening. And we were all still very much within the mindset of the global war on terrorism. You know, I was involved with that, and my predecessors were, and even in the federal government here stateside, we were still very close in acting with the global war on terrorism. So everything was terrorism-driven. Every event, from the border to the Boston bombing to 9/11 reviews, to certain incidences that were happening throughout the country sporadically, to reviewing every type of active shooter to see if it was a terrorism-related shooting, if there was anything that we could go back into the databases of Facebook and social media and see if these people had any extremist ideologies. You know, this is plain view stuff that you can go back on people's stuff and read. I'm not going to talk about the extracurricular stuff that we could do. But, you know, we would go into sources and methods of trying to find connections that was terrorism related. And I will tell you that, honestly, that was righteous investigations back then. But there was a lot of people set up at the same time. And we know that the FBI would bait and switch people that were mentally impaired, that we would call extremists. But, you know, like the instance of the one young man that was out of Oklahoma who was a severe paranoid schizophrenic that was, since the age of 16, had all of his rights more or less given to his parents. He couldn't own a job. He couldn't have a job, couldn't own a car, could not own a firearm, and he would live with his parents who would be his caretakers for the rest of his life. However, because this kid played video games and because this kid had access to the internet, and for whatever reason, living in Oklahoma, he started to talk about the Oklahoma City bombing, and very paranoid, delusional statements, spontaneous statements were made, and a so-called confidential informant of the FBI got wind of it and turned this kid and played him to the extent that the confidential informant was run off of the mother and father's property trying to gain access to this 21-year-old or 20-year-old kid and trying to take him out of the home, out of the care of the parents, and then to bring him to where? Where did he want to take him? Well, eventually, the FBI, through the use of this confidential informant that was ran off of the property by the father multiple times by now, was able to coax this man, this young man, out of his home into a van that supposedly had explosive-making material in it, and from there to park it next to a bank for whatever reason, and to try and detonate through a cellular device. And they said, oh, look at us. We just stopped another terrorism event like 9/11, like the Boston bombing, like the Oklahoma City bombing, and that this kid was, what, white supremacist? He was anti-government. He was everything that they could say. But you know what they wouldn't tell you? He was very sick. He was on a high dose of medication to control his delusions, to control his schizophrenia, and the FBI played this kid and almost ruined his life. And the parents sued and won. But you won't hear about that, will you? So, that's why I take it upon myself, as a former law enforcement officer who loves law enforcement. I love law enforcement. I love my law enforcement brethren. And I will be thin blue line until I die, because I did the job for 10 years and I know how hard it is. But one of the biggest parts of that is for us to say, when law enforcement does something wrong, you have to own it and you have to make sure it doesn't happen again, which means sniffing out bad cops, which means stopping the illegal transportation of children from one county to the other because they were involved in a child sex trafficking. That's happened multiple times in police departments. And you better not talk about that. You better not name names. Because if you do, you may just drive into an explosion one day. Okay? So I take great risk talking about stuff like this. But what I'm telling you, you can find open source on the Google machine, on the internet, and you can look this up. You can validate what I'm saying. The problem really comes down to, with January 6th, what can they look up? What can they say? What can they prove? And what power did they give themselves? Because as far as I know, they gave themselves the power illegally to form this committee. And the investigation side of this, does it have a law enforcement side to carry out the further warrants, the tapping of people's phones? What all are they given the power to do? Because if this committee, think about this, guys, if the Democrats, the Democrats have given themselves the power to spy upon the Republicans, does that not smack a little bit of Nazi Germany to you? In Nazi Germany, just for a little quick recap of history, you had various portions of the government that were not on the side of Adolf Hitler. And after the Reichstag fires, Adolf Hitler claimed that one side used a form of domestic terrorism to set the Reichstag building on fire. And so, because the chancellor at that time, Adolf Hitler, was basically in charge of the country, just not over the military, he decided to go ahead and give himself absolute power. So he took over all legislation, he took over all law enforcement, and then, after already being the chancellor, he became the Führer, the overall leader and military leader of Germany. Thus, taking Germany down a spiraling road of storms after storms. I'm trying my best not to swear anymore because I want to be, how do I say this? I want to be a leader in this movement, and I want to set a good example for the young men that are out there. So I'm doing my best not to swear. So if I don't have my colorful language anymore, I apologize. I'll do my best to learn new words. But the storms, the chaos, the prophecy that unfolded because of Adolf Hitler's journey, his taking over of the government, set forth a series of events and narratives that this world will echo for the rest of our lives. Every generation of people born in this world right now will be told of Adolf Hitler and what he did. And every time a new generation is told, a little piece of history is lost. Because with every new generation, there's a new reason to hide what they did, to hide how bad Nazi Germany really was. And they will give themselves excuses as to why we should never repeat it, but at the same time, we should never repeat the telling of the history. See, these people say, we shouldn't repeat history. Well, I'll tell you, why is it that we're not repeating the telling of history? Once again, Doug wanted to get out of the government and become a history teacher. When I got out of the government, that's the first thing I thought of, because for years I've been considering getting out of the government because I saw the direction it was going. And through a series of events that I can only say was dictated by God, I got out. But I sit here and I look at myself and I say, there's no way that I could go and teach a basic history class or even a college level history class and get away with it anymore, because you're not allowed to talk about truth. You're not allowed to talk about facts. Just like Joe Biden said in 2020, right? We're here for truth, not facts. Truth is an opinionated statement based off of your emotional response to a series of narratives and events. Truth is something that people will go out and look for the truth. Very few people go out and look for the facts, okay? The truth of the matter, and let's just dive off here for a second. The truth of the matter is that there is Bigfoot encounters, over 10,000 of them, across the nation. The fact of the matter is that every time you go to take a picture, it's blurry, it's distorted, and we never get any good factual evidence that you can take to a court and prove with a jury of your peers that you saw something. 9 times out of 10, I'd say 99% out of 100, your evidence will be thrown out of court. But people are still seeing something. All right. That segue went the wrong way. I'm doing a big Bigfoot thing right now. Anyways, let's get back on this. The reason why I should be telling you to be worried about the January 6th committee is that we have a president who recently labeled half of the country to be violent extremists, and then he would say the ultra MAGA are the biggest risk to the country or the biggest security risk to our Constitution, says the man who wants to get rid of parts of the Constitution. Joe Biden has recently said, you don't have a right to the Second Amendment. It was never an inherent right. Did I wake up one morning and become ignorant of the past? I don't think Joe Biden did either. Joe Biden knows exactly what he's talking about. He's using particular words, and he will have evidence, his manufactured evidence, that will be given to him by the Supreme Court, and it will be dictated by we the people. And let me tell you why. Every time there's an active shooter, there's an emotional outburst. Every time there's an emotional outburst, there's a my child died, we need to do something with these guns, like the idiot Matthew McConaughey, who used to be one of my favorite actors, Texas native, and now he's out there in front of the White House or during the White House briefing giving his spiel about guns. Remember, this man's an actor, by the way. But when you get all these people together, they will form the public necessity for response. Public necessity for response. What do I mean by that? During Hurricane Katrina, there was an outcry of a public necessity of response because George W. Bush did not give enough of the FEMA outreach or direction by FEMA to go out and respond to what was happening. And, you know, by the time Katrina was over, it was a mess. I lived through part of that. It was a mess. And there just was not enough incentive from the government to go and preemptively help. So what do? They show up and they have disaster recovery centers where people can come and they can report damage for insurance reasons. And then the government, through Small Business Association and FEMA, would then cut you a little check and go home and don't say anything else about it. As we used to say while we were in Iraq dealing with the Iraqis, whenever they would ask us to do something and we never produced anything for them because we didn't have the time, luxury, or money to do it with, we would tell them, inshallah, we will bring you more food. Or inshallah, hopefully we can stop the fighting around your area. Or inshallah, we will try and rebuild your school the third time. By that I mean the area that I was at, there was a school that was destroyed twice with children in it. So, as per usual, the government shows up at the wrong time And typically, you don't see anything done about it by the government until a couple years later. And then they say, well, because of the public outcry and because the lives lost, we are going to go out and we're going to do X, Y, and Z and show our patriotism because we can't let the American public down. Let me tell you something, guys. And everyone who listens to me is a very, I would say, astute student of history. You need to be if you're going to listen to me. And if not, you're at least very aware of what's happening in the news. They're lying to you. They're lying to you, and they're hoping that they can use your emotional outbursts because you see death and destruction. And they can use that emotion as a driving force for the next series of events, because they've already had a narrative wrote for what we're talking about now. The narrative was wrote probably 5 years ago, whenever the House bills were being introduced for the banning of firearms. And what type of firearms? Semi-automatic firearms, large caliber firearms, suppressors, armor that the civilian populace could own, night vision. I don't think thermal optics were on there, but hey, let's just throw it on there. Thermal optics, right? Any type of accessory that you could put onto a rifle. So by that, I mean a flashlight, a laser device, a hand stop device. Anything that you can put on as an accessory of a firearm, you would have to have had an FFL license in order to purchase it. And then put it on there. You'll have to have a tax stamp for every one of them. At one point, that was one of the documents that I was reading. And I remember back then I was talking to some U.S. attorneys about it. And I'm like, you guys got to be kidding me. They're really thinking about doing this? Half of them would say, don't worry about it. They'll never get it passed. And then the other half would tell me, they're going to keep pushing this forward and take advantage of every single active shooter until eventually the public will tell the government to do it. And that's where I paused and went, huh, never thought about that angle. So when you see these people from the government, from Congress, from Senate, like AOC going out to the border, supposedly, and standing next to a fence and having her fake little cry about how people are being thrown in cages, which, by the way, we were doing that because of Obama. And then the outcry. And then the publicity, and then the mainstream media machine comes and attacks Border Patrol 24/7. That's all you heard about. It's no different than what we see now. It's no different. They're using the same modus operandi for what they're doing. Everything that you hear right now from the January 6th committee is a 1984 throwback lie. This is a deciding factor of our history as Americans. Whatever it is that they come out with, they're going to blame Donald Trump. They're going to blame every political leader that was there. They're going to blame anyone that was affiliated with anyone there as an accomplice. They've already stated that. The Department of Homeland Security has already labeled most of the people that were there as to be a violent domestic extremist. I remember years and years ago, this had to have been 2014, 2015, probably 2015, when I first saw the words, and it's changed, but it's the same thing. When I first saw the words counter-violent extremism, and at that point in time, Barack Obama had this wrote out, and it was on the DHS website. You had to know where to look to find it, but it was about 70 pages of talking about counter-violent extremism, and it very much sounded to me like what we would in the military were called COINOPS, counterinsurgency operations, and by that, they were trying to figure out how to set up the intelligence gathering and then the enforcement, the policies and procedures and laws that would precede the Counterviolent Extremism Act or agency or policy or law. They didn't really know which way they wanted to take it. But I remember while I'm reviewing these pages, and I get to about page 68, and then I hit the nitty-gritty of what I wanted to find. And I thought this interesting. I'll tell you guys what I found. And you can't find this anymore on the government pages, so all you federal employees are out there, go ahead and try and find it if you can. But I think it's page 68. It says that counterviolent extremism will eventually come to the place where we will have a federal agency that will have a liaison officer for every single police department in America, from the small towns, so the sheriff's departments, the small town police departments, the state police departments, or state law enforcement. And then they will have a direct communication back and forth from the government, which basically means that the government would provide oversight to every single law enforcement branch and agency in America upon the state, county, and local level, which is not happening right now. So along with that, we got a thing called fusion centers. Now, fusion centers are nefarious in nature, but not in reality. All a fusion center is, and there's only, you know, they're across the nation. I know Alex Jones and others made a real big deal about this, but as someone who's been to a fusion center, and I know people that work there, I'm telling you, it's stupid that people really made a big deal about this. But all a fusion center was a ability for multiple agencies, from the states to the locals to the federals, to have one person assigned to that fusion center so that when a terrorist action happened or a natural disaster happened, or like an active shooter or a large bank robbery or kidnapping situation happened, the information could be passed to the fusion center and then disseminated to all the people within all the other agencies, all the other different LEO agencies that are there, to include fire and rescue, who would also have a man there. And then we would all get, hopefully, to hear the same information at the same time, which was one of the reasons for the creation of the Department of Homeland Security within the federal government, because during 9/11, we had 50 different agencies who could not talk to each other and, to the extent, would not talk to each other, like the FBI right now, the Department of Justice. When I worked for Homeland Security, whenever we would try to talk with FBI, if you weren't in the same building and you couldn't go up and knock on the door and talk to the SAC or the ASAC, which is the Assistant Special Agent in Charge or the Special Agent in Charge, you pretty much didn't talk to the FBI. And if we wanted to ask, hey, what is your, you know, stats for this area for whatever intelligence that you have on, you know, this terror incident or this gang, you had to really beg and plead at times to get actual information out. That's not very helpful, all right? Especially when we're all supposed to be one fight, one team. The problem with a lot of this is that a lot of us returning vets, we all have that mindset. One fight, one team. One fight, one team. We're all blue. We all carry badges and guns, and we're all going to potentially give our lives for the action of protecting this country and protecting the civilians. So let's at least talk to one another. Never happens. Never happens. Not on the way that it should. Whenever there's a large operation and we have a conglomerate together and you use the fusion centers that activate, or there'll be a command center that'll activate, and sometimes we'll put all of our eggs in one basket so we can all talk to each other. Okay, occasionally that happens. But on the day by day, very rarely does that happen. Now, there are certain law enforcement groups that do talk to each other, especially within the realms of illegal drug actions. We will talk to each other pretty well on that one. Interdiction groups. But that's a whole nother thing. What we're talking about now is the dissemination of information from all federal groups. And counterviolent extremism did something that, as a student of history, really stood out to me. And the fact was that every single law enforcement office in America would have a federal officer superseding it. Not in charge of it, but superseding it as a liaison officer. Do you know who also did that? You guessed it. Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany. The SS took all components of all law enforcement and investigative branches and put them all underneath the SS. And then from there, the SS had a man in every single office to disseminate information back and forth. That way there's always a line, an open line of communication. From there, it grew to the extent that the government, the SS government, then took over every single law enforcement branch. And from there, there was no longer the excuse to be a good guy. You were a bad guy in a bad system, even if you were a good guy. That is why I see January 6th as a very serious problem. We are starting to repeat history. And because these things are unfolding slowly in front of you, and because they don't get that much limelight, and there's not that much that's being said about it, when you hear someone who understands history and they tell you that we are paralleling Nazi Germany, well, I would hope that you would pay attention to it. Do your own investigative work on this, all right? Let me give you, real quick, a place to go to so that you can vet this information. Because I'll tell you this, just because I tell you it doesn't mean that I can't be wrong, doesn't mean that I can't be inaccurate, doesn't mean that my emotions can't lead me astray, but I do my best to take those elements out and to give you factual history. Not very many other people do that from what I know. A lot of the other guys that are in radio are shock jocks. They want to get your attention so that they can get those subscribers and get a little bit more money. I just want to get proper information out there to you. Okay? So stand by. Let me pull something up for you. Okay, so this is from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. It's probably one of the most accurate and professional databases that's out there on the internet to pull up factual stuff that happened in Nazi Germany. All right, so this is titled SS Police State. Now, I'm just going to read it to you. And as I read it to you, I just want you to sit back and just think of all the crazy stuff you've heard about the government recently, from Obama to the stuff happening during Trump with the elections, all the way to the modern day Reichstag fire, which was January 6th. And then you have a president now who wants to ban guns, who wants to blah, blah, blah. And then they have their own committee with a reason to then identify half the nation as a violent extremist. Let's see if this pans out in history. Okay, here we go. An important tool of Nazi terror was the Protective Squad, the Schutzstaffel, or SS, which began as a special guard for Adolf Hitler and other party leaders. The black-shirted SS members formed a smaller elite group whose members also served as an auxiliary policeman and later as concentration camp guards. Eventually overshadowing the stormtroopers, which was called the SA, in importance, the SS became, after 1934, the private army of the Nazi Party. SS Chief Heinrich Himmler also turned the regular non-party police forces into an instrument of terror. He helped forge the powerful secret state police, the Staatspolizei, or Gestapo. These non-uniformed police used ruthless and cruel methods throughout Germany to identify and arrest political opponents and others who refused to obey laws and policies of Nazi Germany. In the months after Hitler took power, the brown shirts and Gestapo agents went from door to door looking for Hitler's enemies: socialist, communist, trade union leaders, and others who had spoken out against the Nazi Party were arrested and some were killed. By the middle of 1933, the Nazi Party was the only political party and nearly all organized opposition to the regime had been eliminated. Democracy was dead in Germany by 1933. Many different groups, including the stormtroopers and the SS, set up hundreds of makeshift camps in empty warehouses, factories, and other locations all over Germany where they held political opponents without trial and under conditions of great cruelty. One of these camps was set up on March 20th, 1933, at Dachau, in an abandoned munitions factory from World War I. Located near Munich in southwestern Germany, Dachau would become the model concentration camp for a vast system of SS camps. Here are some key dates to pay attention to. February 22nd, 1933, the SS and the SA, which is the Schutzstaffel, SS, and the Brown Shirts, became auxiliary police units. Less than a month after Adolf Hitler is appointed Chancellor of Germany, he calls on elements of the Nazi Party to act as auxiliary police. The SS, initially Hitler's bodyguards, and the SA, the street fighters or stormtroopers of the Nazi Party, now have official police power. This further increases the power of the Nazi Party in German society. So, what does that entail to right now? Well, do you remember when a certain man named Barack Obama said we need a civilian military, a civilian police force just as big and just as strong, just as well funded, just as well powerful? That would be your Black Lives Matter. That would be your Antifa. That is the thugs that these types of people will pay to be their enforcement wing. And all they have to do is deputize them. All they have to do is deputize these people, and they now have law enforcement power. That's all it takes. All right. February 28th, 1933, the Reichstag fire decree empowers police. An emergency decree following the burning of the Reichstag, the German parliament, on February 27th, 1933, grants the police almost unlimited power of arrest. This is the part that bothers me about the January 6th committee, granting themselves the unlimited power of arrest. This power is known as protective custody. So if you ever hear the term protective custody being used within the next recent months, pay attention. In National Socialist terminology, protective custody means the arrest of potential opponents of the regime without benefit of a trial or judicial proceedings. Does that sound familiar to anyone yet? Protective custody and their prisoners are confined not in the normal prison system, but in concentration camps. These camps were initially established by the stormtroopers, the SA, and later came under the exclusive authority of the chief of the SS, the elite guard of the Nazi state. All throughout America are abandoned warehouses and encampments that DHS has made or it does have some sort of control over. Typically, these encampments will be used in the industrial park area of your city where all the large warehouses are. Just for example, in 2018, when I was working the border, we were bringing people to a location that was ran by Red Cross in about 1 million square foot warehouse, and it could easily fit 10,000 people in there. Now, once we capture people and they're processed, they're then handed over to third-party actors, which would be your non-government associations, your NGOs, and whatever happens to them from there happens. We don't know. We don't follow up. So I know when I went into one of these buildings and I just was aghast. I just looked around. I said, my Lord, there's at least 3,000 to 5,000 cots sitting right here in front of me. So these areas don't have to be some auspicious camp surrounded by barbed wire out in the middle of the woods. Most likely, they're going to be used in your industrial parks, your abandoned warehouses. They'll be on abandoned military bases, or even to the extent I do remember up in the north, I believe it was in Maryland, where we used a abandoned college campus to bring refugees from the border in. So wherever those people are transported, you can easily put political prisoners. Just saying. All right, let's continue. March 20th, 1933. Heinrich Himmler announces the opening of Dachau. The Dachau camp located near Munich in southern Germany is one of the first concentration camps established by the Nazis. SS Chief Heinrich Himmler, who, by the way, was the supreme law enforcement officer of the land, announces its opening on March 20th, 1933. The first prisoners arrive on March 22nd, 2 days later. They are mainly communist and socialist. And all that translates to you right now is that if it's the Democrats in power, then it was Republicans and MAGA. It was conservatives and whatever group that they want to label as violent domestic extremists. Dachau is the only camp to remain in operation from 1933 until 1945. June 17th, 1936. Heinrich Himmler becomes chief of the German police. Adolf Hitler appoints SS Chief Heinrich Himmler chief of all German police units. All police powers are now centralized. The Gestapo, the German secret state police, comes under Himmler's control. Responsible for state security, it has the authority to send individuals to concentration camps, and members of the Gestapo are often also members of the SS. So, rolling right along with that, let's talk about propaganda and censorship. The Nazis wanted Germans to support the Nazi dictatorship and believe in Nazi ideas. To accomplish this goal, they try to control forms of communication through censorship and propaganda. This included control of the newspapers, the magazines, books, art, theater, music, movies, and radio. Translate that to America today. That's your mainstream media. That's your Hollywood elite. That is your Amazon, your Netflix, your Hulu channels. That's your YouTube, your Rumble, whatever, whatever. All social media censorship that's out there as well. Look at all the bots that are being discovered on Twitter. They're using everything that is an information gathering tool and an information exploration tool. So being able to project information, TV, social media, your phone, the applications on your phone, that is used for propaganda, for censorship, and for intelligence gathering. And do not think it's not. So how did the Nazis use censorship? When the Nazis came into power in 1933, the German Constitution guaranteed them freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Through decrees and laws, the Nazis abolished these civil rights and destroyed German democracy. Starting in 1934, it was illegal to criticize the Nazi government. Even telling a joke about Hitler was considered treachery. Sound familiar, China? People in Nazi Germany could not say or write whatever they wanted anymore. Examples of this type of censorship under the Nazis included closing down or taking over anti-Nazi newspapers, controlling what news appeared in newspapers, on the radio, and in newsreels, banning and burning books that the Nazis categorized as un-German, controlling what soldiers wrote home during World War II. And let's see if this echoes back in today's future, shall we? Stand by. So, reverberating back from the past and seeing if we can parallel this to the future, The National Terrorism Advisory System Bulletin from the Department of Homeland Security posted this on June 7th, 2022. The United States remains in a heightened threat environment, as noted in the previous bulletin, which would have been February 7th, and several recent attacks have highlighted the dynamic and complex nature of the threat environment. In the coming months, we expect the threat environment to become more dynamic as several high-profile events could be exploited to justify acts of violence against a range of possible targets. These targets could include public gatherings, faith-based institutions, schools, racial and religious minorities, government facilities and personnel, U.S. critical infrastructure, the media, and perceived ideological components. Really, the media? Threat actors have recently mobilized to violence due to factors such as personal grievances, reactions to current events, and adherence to violent extremist ideologies, including racially or ethnically motivated or anti-government, anti-authority, violent extremism. Foreign adversaries, including terrorist organizations and nation-state adversaries, also remain intent on exploiting the threat government to promote or inspire violence, sow discord, or undermine U.S. democratic institutions. We continue to assess the primary threat of mass casualty violence in the United States system from lone offenders and small groups motivated by a range of ideological beliefs and or personal grievances. Now, previously, back in February, what they were talking about was the use of media and the internet to promote misinformation, malinformation, disinformation, and their need, as you recently saw with the Council of Truth, to be able to advise on whether or not you should be able to talk with free speech on the internet about anything that you wanted to. So the government, and it's still in the works, this didn't go away, the government is currently looking at ways to curtail your free speech upon social media and internet platforms. I say maybe the day is coming back where we need to start gathering in town squares and standing up on our soapboxes again. Maybe then we can get the truth back out, the honest truth, the real truth. Because everything that you say can, will, and most definitely is used against you in this current regime. Let's see what Nazi Germany did. So how did the Nazis use propaganda? The Nazis used propaganda to promote their ideas and beliefs. Beginning in March 1933, the regime tried to centralize its propaganda efforts in a new ministry led by Joseph Goebbels. This ministry was called the Reich Ministry of Enlightenment and Propaganda. The Nazis used a variety of propaganda tools to spread Nazi ideas. Examples of propaganda under the Nazis include, pay attention, glorifying Adolf Hitler by using his image on postcards, posters, and in the press. Remember when they did that about Obama? Spreading negative images and ideas about Jews in magazines, films, cartoons, and other media. That's what they're doing now about MAGA and Trump. Making radios more affordable so that more Germans could listen to Nazi ideas and the news. That's exactly what they're doing with people coming across the border and voting. You want a new car, you want a new house, you want free money, free food, vote this direction. Broadcasting Nazi speeches on the radio and public loudspeakers. That's coming. Trust me when I say that's coming. Organizing large and celebratory Nazi party rallies. We're not there yet, but these are events that are being wrote. Creating groups like the Hitler Youth and the League of German Girls that fostered Nazi ideas. That's your Black Lives Matter. That's your BAMF. That is your Antifa groups. That is your anti-government groups. That's your true fascist groups. So how did the propaganda and censorship work together? Textbooks are a good example of how propaganda and censorship work together in Nazi regime. The Nazis used both propaganda and censorship to control what students read in school. Nazi censors removed some textbooks from classrooms, and new textbooks taught students to obey the Nazi Party, to love Adolf Hitler, and to hate the Jew. That's your critical race theory. That's your LGBTQRS fairy tale creature labeling. That's your gender disinformation, malinformation, misinformation. Here's some key dates before we leave. May 10th, 1933, the Nazi book burning. During the spring of 1933, Nazi universities, student organizations, professors, and librarians put together long lists of books that they think are un-German. These lists include books written by Jewish authors. They also included books by non-Jewish authors whose ideas conflict with Nazi ideals. On the night of May 10th, 1933, Nazis hold the book burnings. They march by torchlight and nighttime parades, sing chants, and throw books into huge bonfires. On the night, more than 25,000 books are burned on one night. March 28, 1933, the premiere of the propaganda film Triumph of the Will. Leni Riefenstahl's propaganda film Triumph of the Will premieres in Berlin. The film would show footage taken at the 1933-34 Nazi Party rally in Nuremberg. The footage from the rally shows smiling children, cheering crowds, and uniformed Nazis. It features military parades and a speech by Adolf Hitler. Triumph of the will become one of the most infamous Nazi propaganda films. And that was Joseph Goebbels' big thing, was propaganda films. 1939, the banning Germans from listening to foreign radios. World War II begins on September 1st, 1939. Shortly afterwards, the Nazi regime makes listening to foreign radio broadcasts illegal. This is an attempt to control what information Germans hear about the war. The Nazi regime sees the news and information from outside Germany as a security threat. They are worried about foreign radio broadcasts, which some Germans can access on their home radios. Later in the war, the regime even sentences people to death for listening to foreign radio stations. That's all we got for today, friends. Know your history. Do not be fooled by the lies that they're telling you right now in this government. Stay frosty. The enemy is out there. My name's Doug Thornton. You've been listening to the American Vindicta Show. I'm out. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.